Welcome to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your radio reading service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from Bob Tart's book, Kitty Cornered, How Franny and Five Other Incorrigible Cats Seized Control of Our House and Made It Their Home. And if we have some time, I'll be reading articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to begin today's readings with Bob Tart's book, Kitty Cornered. In the last reading, we learned that Bob introduced us to the cats in his life, and he noted very distinctly that each cat has its own personality. In the post-potluck days that followed, as Linda rattled back to the store for soy milk or to the post office for stamps with pretty flowers on them, or to the dime store for plastic wading pools for our pets, ducks, geese, she saw the cat in ever-increasing proximity to our home. I feared that it was only a matter of time before the kitty would stumble onto the secret messages that other strays had left in the woods to guide more strays to our doorstep. In a language of scents and signs that only felines could decipher, an old mouse skeleton here, the heavily scratched bark of a sapling there, the cat calligraphy would tell her that in the blue house between the river and the road lived people who would shower her with food and affection. Two softies whom even the dullest-witted critter could effortlessly wrap around its little toe. Food and affection she would get, assuming she was just stopping by for a takeout and not intending to reserve an inside table. We already had three cats, and we definitely didn't need a fourth. Agnes, Mooby, and our more recent acquisition, Lucy, gave us more trouble than our 50-some pets put together. I kept telling myself that good qualities more than outweighed the negatives, just as I also imagined that our parrots were mild-mannered and our geese as quiet as falling snow. I hadn't grown up loving animals. In fact, I had been diffident to them in my boyhood. But marrying country gal Linda Sue 17 years ago flipped on a switch that had been so deeply embedded in the whorls and dead ends of my fractured psyche that I'd never even dreamed it existed. Two of our first pets were profoundly unsuitable for companionship with humans. When we weren't besieging their previous owners for advice, we were trying to eject them from our lives until we discovered that we had fallen hard for them. Belligerent bunny Binky and Mussolini of a pocket parrot, Ollie, relentlessly bossed us, put their sparkling personalities, filled our house with jagged light. My brother-in-law soon brought us a Muscovy duck that his co-workers had been pelting with stones, so more homeless quackers and consequent backyard pen expansions followed. Then came a quartet of geese abandoned in a roadside ditch, an increasingly affable succession of rabbits, African gray parrots, parakeets, doves, hens, and cats, not to mention the orphan songbirds that Linda raised and released each summer. Though I might call any of them baby, I never thought of our animals as surrogate children. I was the infant of the house, whiny, weak, helpless, crabby, and frequently in need of a nap. I was still trying to learn resilience from our pets, since the smallest bantam chicken was stronger, smarter, and more emotionally balanced than I ever were. But the best that I could muster was an extra smidgen of patience. I needed it to deal with the parent who had devoured the dining room wood, or the goose-sized duck with the vice-grip beak who thrived on chasing us around the barn. Mostly, I loved our animals for their flighty yet constant companionship and the way their wildness was mitigated by an addiction to comfort. Dusty the parrot had learned to call Mooby by name. Ruby the rabbit had started mountain goating up the backrest of the couch. Goose Liz stared longingly at the bowl of cat food that Linda had set for the white and blaze stray. The kibbles were untouched. Then one afternoon, the wisp of the winds became flesh and dwelled out our sunflower seed feeder, scattered the three sparrows to the winds, and I grew alarmed. I didn't want her munching on wild birds that already had enough trouble surviving a cold and sunless winter. She was white with mostly black hind legs that made her look as if we were wearing a pair of tights that were falling down. Her tail was black, a black continent floated in a sea of white on her right side, and a few black islands had broken off and drifted to her left side, shoulders, neck, and head. Although her eyes weren't large by cat standards, they formed an alliance with her pink nose to dominate her slender face when she peered up toward the house. She looked smaller and more delicate than I had expected. The bright white expanse of her fur embarrassed the dinginess of the compact snow, made the cloudy sky seem even gloomier. The flitting of goldfinches to and from the seed perches apparently didn't interest her, nor did a feed-robbing squirrel who hung back behind the pump house, flicking his tail as he scolded her. She seemed fixated on some other concern. Her body twitched as she sat. It could have been a reaction to the cold, but I feared that she was pretending to ignore the birds while on the verge of an explosive strike. I leaned forward to scare her away before she managed to snag a goldfinch. But before I could knock on the bathroom window, she glanced up at me at first, and then with a heart-shaped face, she meowed. One moment she was crouching on the icy ground, a leap away from the feeder. The next moment she was melting into the woods, running until her white and black coat faded to a gray smudge on the riverbank. The merest flicker of an eye contact had passed between us, but in the brief instant between the crouching and the rocking away, as my cloudy blue eyes met her metallic yellows, I felt a spark of a connection between us. It was a serious crush, though I had no idea at the time how deeply she would set her hooks into me. Partly she had moved me in the same way that many homeless animals would, but I also recognized a special quality in her that resonated with my own temperament. In my scant few seconds observing her, I had identified a kindred spirit, a creature who, in spite of her many strengths, was apparently as anxiety-laden as I was. She was a shadow, afraid of a shadow. I told Linda about my encounter, leaving out the touchy-feely neurotic aspects. I put a dish of kibble out for her in Don's driveway last night in case she didn't find the dish out back, she told me, referring to our former neighbor's empty house, but it looks like a raccoon got to it first. The food was spilled all over the driveway, and the dish was all chewed up. I was ashamed for myself for blowing the white and black kitty's chance for an easy bowl of kittle, but Agnes soon reminded me why I should be focusing on the troublemakers inside the house. After ducking into the kitchen to retrieve my coffee from the microwave, I padded down the hallway toward Mubi. She broke off from noisily crunching on her food to fix me with a high-voltage, "I want" stare, intent on scoring a tastier morsel. Agnes was nowhere in sight, for the moment at least. Puffing on the hot handle of my South Dakota's Badland mug, I bent down to scratch the top of Mubi's head as I passed her on my way to check my email. Then I took a fateful step around the corner. Agnes, having overheard Mubi's noisy grazing, had positioned herself on the other side of the wall and was lying in wait for her. My stocking foot unfortunately made an appearance first. Needle-sharp teeth pierced my skin. I went airborne, rejecting a sparrow-sized glob of hot coffee from my cup. The liquid hung in space, whistling a happy tune and biding its time until my as-yet uninjured other foot moved directly below. Then it descended in a steaming splash. Deeply offended by my hopping and cussing, Agnes shot up the stairs. After fortifying my feet with shoes, I felt contrite all over again about having uprooted the white and black cat. Although I couldn't make atonement to the stray, I could do the next best thing by apologizing to Agnes for spoiling one of her few indoor pleasures. Agnes was the embodiment of rolling-on-the-ground warmth if you encountered her outside in the temperate months. But imprisoned inside the house during our endless winter, she got so grumpy that if someone substituted a wolverine in her place, I wouldn't have noticed. I discovered her curled up on my office chair during her best impression of a life preserver. Her eyes shuttered open and regarded me warily. "What a good, good girl you are," I said, and I reached out to stroke the curve of her back. Quick as a chameleon's tongue, a paw lashed out to bat my hand away. I had ignored the fact that Agnes could only be petted at certain times of the day, and only then if a particular set of legalistic conditions had been met. Although no one but Agnes had a clue as to what these conditions might be, a bad mood rendered every other consideration null and void. For failing to take her temperament into account, I had earned the exercise of her claws, cause. The night, just before Linda and I snapped off the light, for an all-too-brief respite, Agnes leaped upon the bed and rubbed her face against my fingers. Complex feeding, watering, and out-of-cage shifts for our pets meant that there was barely an hour of delight that didn't involve a task, although strangely, I had discovered that I liked the structure that it lent my life. Each chore was like the picket of a fence that helped keep worry, obsessive thinking, guilt, and fantasies of success out of reach. But reliance on routine also made me less open to the deviations from the norm, and I didn't embrace this unusual 11th hour interplay with Agnes. She was insistent to the point of muzzling her hand even more after I had stuck it under my pillow. And 1, 2, 3, even 50 strokes weren't enough to satisfy her. She demanded to be petted, neck rubbed, and back scratched until she had covered my entire arm in electrostatically charged coating of shredded hair. In the end, I enjoyed it almost as much as she did. I could never look at a cat without longing to touch it, and Agnes quenched my kitty petting thirst far into the distant future. "What a good, good girl you are," I told her as I hugged her, and this time she agreed. As I squirted green dishwashing detergent onto the living room rug and scrubbed our newest stain, Linda mentioned having seen the white and black stray eating from the bowl behind the fence. "I'm glad you're feeding her," I said, "but I don't want her hanging around all the time and thinking she belongs here. Next thing you know, she'll be throwing up on the carpet like Mubi." "Did you give Mubi her hairball medicine?" "I squeezed a slug into her food this morning. It's already gone." Linda assured me that a stray cat this skitterish would never come anywhere near us, much less amble indoors, confer with Mubi, and leave me a present to step on in the morning. Still, even the most misanthropic wild creatures sometimes developed a tolerance for humans when they needed help. We had experienced this with injured songbirds, hungry turkeys, and down on their luck, realtors. The past summer, a friend of ours had found juvenile downy woodpecker on the ground after a storm and brought the tyke to us. He was already weak when we put him in our large outdoor flight cage. He refused to eat and spent every waking moment hammering away at the cage. Finally, we opened the door and let him go because there was nothing else we could do. 2 days later, Linda's gardening helper said, "Did you see that bird on your wreath?" The little woodpecker was clinging to the plastic dollar store flowers that adorned our front door. Back in his once hated cage, he let me feed him with a syringe, and by the next morning, we were eagerly pecking at a block of suet. After we let him go, he still frequented the yard, and he trusted us to come quite close while he was feeding. So, as I spotted the kitty hunched up against our pump house the following afternoon, I wondered whether the bitter cold might make her more friendly, more people-friendly. She was obviously lingering in our yard. I snuck a long look at her through the bathroom mini-blinds. Her face was beautiful, small and sleek like a ferret's, and with a steely demeanor that had little in common with the complacency of a domesticated cat. She bristled with nervous energy. Even at the rest, she seemed in implied motion and never relaxed her guard. But a divided cap of black fur on top of her white head undercut her serious expression. It reminded me of Alfalfa's slicked down and parted hairdo from the Argang comedies and increased the inexplicable stab of affection that struck me as I started. She seemed to sense that I was watching her. I ducked just as she lifted her head toward the window, but not before I noticed a strange discolored stripe that ran down her nose and lip. I decided to venture out with food so that she would associate me with something positive. I also wanted to get a closer peek at the mark on her face. After donning 15 pounds of winter outerwear, gloves, boots, cleats, and scarves, I made my exit from the basement as unobtrusively as possible, softly easing the door open and letting her see my cherubic expression through the pickets of our gate. "Alfalfa gal, I've got food for you," I started to coo, but she wasn't ready for the close-up. Before I could get the phrase past my tongue, she was already just a memory. Over the next few days, I assured myself that I was simply indulging in the feline equivalent of scanning the snowy wastes for red poles and other winter finches. But my thrumming heart gave the lie to my brain, and when I saw the stray at a distance stalking mice in our frozen swamp or skulking near a pile of branches where tree sparrows hid, the close encounter had evidently spooked her. Now she wouldn't come anywhere close to the house. Once, I caught her glancing up from our field to see my stick figure in the dining room picture window, and even the low-res view caused her to hightail it. Churning up a spray of ice crystals in her wake, she tore across the tundra, racing all the way to the river, where a trickle of unfrozen water might wash away the hideousness of the sight. Next week, we'll continue reading about this black and white kitty stray in the book Kitty Cornered by Bob Tart. Our next reading comes from The Seeing Eye Guide, a magazine for friends of the seeing eye. It's the Fall 2025, Volume 91, Number 2 edition. The article is called Haben Girma, Seeing Eye and Harvard Law Grad Says Including People Who Are Disabled Builds Stronger Communities for All. Haben Girma was an undergrad at Lewis and Clark College when she first came to the seeing eye in 2009 to be matched with Maxine, a German Shepherd. 16 years later, she's working with her second, a German Shepherd named Milo. "As a deafblind woman, I feel a greater sense of freedom having Milo by my side." In between, Haben graduated from Harvard Law School, received the Helen Keller Achievement Award, was named to the Forbes 30 Under 30 list, was honored at the White House as a champion of change, gave a TED Talk, won a court case advocating on behalf of the National Federation of the Blind, traveled the world teaching organizations how to build inclusive communities, and wrote a best-selling book, Haben, the Deafblind Woman Who Conquered Harvard Law. But despite all she's done, Haben says many seek to define her by what she can't do. "The biggest barrier I face is ableism, the widespread belief and practice that values non-disabled people over disabled people," she said. Haben said she wanted to become a lawyer to advocate for people with disabilities. She applied to several law schools, including Harvard Law. Haben was told by Harvard Law, "We never had a deafblind student before." Haben said in her keynote address at the Seeing Eye Gala on May 7th, "I told them I've never been to Harvard before." She became the first deafblind person to graduate from Harvard Law, saying she recharged by playing fetch with Milo on campus. Helen Keller really wanted to go to Harvard, but back then, the only admitted men. Helen's disability wasn't a problem. Her gender wasn't a problem. The problem was Harvard, Haben said. Over time, the school changed and opened its doors to women and people with disabilities. "Deaf, blind women have always been brilliant. It's society that needs to learn to adapt and make sure all of our different schools and programs are accessible for everyone." Haben said her disability isn't something she's overcome. "I'm still deaf and blind, but she has adapted to it. I can read and write Braille with my fingertips, and my senses of touch, taste, and smell convey so much more information about the world. When Milo wants my attention, he will nudge my hand. When he moves in the harness, I feel the vibrations travel up his harness to my hand. Walking with Milo feels like dancing with a partner." But often people with disabilities are seen outsiders who must fit themselves into a society designed for others. Communities succeed when they innovate to dismantle barriers and be inclusive to move us all forward, she said. An inclusive society is stronger, more resilient, and more connected. Haben recently named a soon-to-be-born seeing-eye puppy, Harley, honoring her cherished elder U.S. Coast Guard captain, Harley Clow. Harley guided millions of people through dangerous Alaskan waters, and he had tremendous respect for seeing-eye dogs navigating across the treacherous obstacles on land. So said Haben Girma. And this article is about Haben Girma, seeing-eye, and Harvard Law grads say including people who are disabled builds stronger communities for all. Allison Cochiara writes the next article, How Two Horses Went From Stranded Survivors to Friends. Stranded on a remote beach of Lake Powell in Arizona with nothing but wind and water for company, a lone mare clung to survival. No herd, no shelter, no one to nuzzle or nudge, just solo, living up to her name. Now, with hooves planted firmly in the red dirt of Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, Horse Haven, Solo is slowly beginning to trade solitude for something softer, safety, curiosity, the quiet comfort of companionship. Solo's path to the sanctuary was no easy one. Her rescue from Lake Powell was a joint effort by Best Friends, the National Park Service, the Navajo Nation, and a few kind-hearted Arizonan locals who had been delivering hay to her for more than 18 months and ultimately spearheaded the rescue effort. At first, there was cautious hope she might make her way out on her own when the water receded, but as the seasons passed and she remained stranded, it became clear that help would have to come to her. Coordinating access across shifting shorelines, tribal lands, and protected areas took time and patience, but once everything aligned, the team moved quickly. What followed was an epic journey, a boat ride, a trailer, and a whole lot of heart. It took 4 hours just to get Solo from the beach into the trailer on the boat, followed by a 90-minute drive to the sanctuary. It was very collaborative. To rescue this one horse, says Jen Reed, senior manager of Horse Haven. But even after she arrived, Solo's journey was far from over. She still carried the invisible weight of solitude, wary of humans, hesitant to trust. She needed someone who could help her bridge the gap. Enter Emma. Emma's story began on those same rugged shores. She, too, was rescued from Lake Powell, only her journey included a foal at her side and a 14-hour rescue full of protective mama energy. When Jen was looking for the right pasture pal for Solo, Emma came to mind immediately, and not because of their shared origin story, though it's a poetic coincidence. It doesn't have much to say to do with similar experience. We just thought that personality-wise, they'd be a good match, says Jen. Emma's quiet confidence is a balm for Solo's slightly wary outlook, and that confidence seems to be rubbing off. So far, it's been a great success, says Jen. The fact that Emma loves people has already helped Solo be more curious about us. Solo still hangs back, but now she watches closely when Emma approaches humans. She sees her new friend enjoying treats and kind hands and seems to be quietly weighing her options. Just recently, Emma ambled up to Jen for a nuzzle, and after a moment, Solo took a few brave steps forward, curious but cautious. It's a small gesture, but for a horse who spent a year and a half on a deserted island, it's monumental. Emma's helping her come out of her cell, says Jen. She's given Solo more confidence with humans. For now, they're settling into the rhythm of shared lives. Different as they are, they're meeting each other in the middle, where friendship lives. And while Solo's future is still unfolding, one thing is certain. She doesn't have to face it alone. Beneath the towering cliffs of Angel Canyon, two mares, once stranded, now stand together, forging something beautiful out of all that came before. This article, written by Allison Cochiara, How Two Horses Went From Stranded Survivors to Friends. How Horses Heal Humans. Gabrielle Gardner believes it's far more symbiotic relationship between horses and humans. Shine for Life, a company offering equine-assisted therapy, was born out of a eureka moment when Gabrielle, who grew up with horses and riding, was on a yoga retreat and a fellow yogi told her about equine therapy. I immediately booked myself on a training course and knew by day two that this was my life's calling. I feel blessed to be able to observe the many healing moments that horses can offer humans. We just need to take a moment to breathe, trust, and take notice, Gabrielle, whose team of therapists, along with her two horses, have worked with clients including autistic children, survivors of domestic violence, and people struggling with addiction, says the majestic creatures can literally sync with humans. Horses' hearts emit electromagnetic signals with an 8-foot wavelength so powerful they make other hearts in the vicinity beat at the same rate. And in the case of humans, that means reducing heart rate by a 1/12. Equine therapy became popular in parts of Europe in the 1950s when it was combined with physiotherapy for those with physical disabilities. In the past 20 years, it's evolved to include psychological therapy as well. There are two aspects to horses' behavior that make them perfect therapy partners. First, they are herd animals, and their social nature makes them want to create bonds. Secondly, they are also prey animals, which makes them expert readers of body language. This means they mirror human behavior, walk into a horse's space with a negative attitude or defensive body language, and the chances are it will not want to interact with you. Approach with a sense of calm, confidence, and openness, however, and the horse will reflect these qualities straight back. This is how horses heal humans. Well, we've come to the end of Animal Companions for today. I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time to hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.